Hello, welcome back, and this is the final stream tonight, and I'm now here with Semi Ogog, and I saw you dancing there. I saw you dancing to the
I was getting down, man. I love the little dude running around the little infinity track. It was mighty, and the best thing ever is the little jingle at the end, which is like the ultimate. It's the ultimate. It's an apotheosis of amount, because it's one bell shake. Nah, man, one little shing, that's it. Boom. Out smooth, man.
Thank you very much. Yeah, well, quite a lot of work did go into that, and I am pleased with it. But anyway, that's all the aesthetic stuff that people aren't generally interested in. So we'll get to the intellectual meat, and which is, of course, what people expect from whenever Semi Ogog appears on Millennial. I think the first time you were on when I was really struggling. I think it was at the end of the night, and I was exhausted. And you were talking about something, and I just couldn't keep up. So I still feel guilty about that now.
It was some kind of abuse on my part towards you, I'm sure. I do recall one of the years when I came on, you were eating a pizza. You were just like, "Hang on, I want to keep the camera off while I eat a pizza." And I was like, "Yes." Yes.
I haven't done that throughout so far. This is the fifth night, and so far I've had one pizza in between two streams, and that's it. Other than that, I play it very safe.
You're on the straight and narrow now, are you?
Yes, I am. Yeah, it's weird. You find these different ways to deal with it, and every year it's slightly different. Okay, so welcome, Semi Ogog, to Millennial. This has been an interesting year. Various things have happened. COVID has ended. I don't quite like that phrasing, because I think it's got long term effects. But nonetheless, obviously, the pandemic is over. And that very quickly almost immediately gave way to the story of the Ukraine war, or the special military operation of Russia in Ukraine. And that's what we're going to start off talking about, I guess. I mean, there's no need for everyone. I think my fans will know you already, so there's no need to introduce yourself at any great length. But, well, we did come up with that tagline together. American content creator, eater of crow, former rake, and proud polymath. So that is Semi Ogog in one nutshell. I'm sure there could be others.
I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself king of infinite space. <you know. laughs>
Indeed. All right. So briefly, then, why don't we start with you giving your nutshell view of the Ukraine conflict?
Well, I'm sure this is going to go over well. I suppose, you know, we could talk about everyone is a Fed, or we could talk about Groypers and Kanye. That might draw down more abuse and controversy. But this one, yeah, generally does seem to be high up on the list for dragging people off to either side.
Oh, my God. I mean, yeah, we could talk about the JQ. We could talk about black rappers. We could talk about sensible
sex and religion.
Or we'll go for Ukraine.
Right. Your mission, should you choose to accept it. Yeah, I'm not going anywhere near sensible centrism. That's more in academic agents territory. I consider myself a mystical centrist. So I'm sensible centrist curious. I'm sensible centrist adjacent. But my center is mystical. Just to be clear.
Okay, a fellow traveler of the sensible centrist. All right, okay. So Ukraine, go for it.
Yeah, Ukraine is interesting to me. You know, I've had my views on it, and they have not changed substantially. The basic one is that the odds very much favor Russia, and I expect them to, at the end of this miserable process, to emerge with a better claim to victory than Ukraine and NATO and the rest. I think everybody is screwed by this. You know, some countries more than others. Perhaps the elite behind it in the United States is the group that will be the least screwed, but the American population is, as we always do, paying for it. Though, of course, by comparison, much less so than even people in the United Kingdom who are trying to pay their electric bills, and to say nothing of people who are being overwhelmed with refugees or, you know, having bombs drop on their heads. So I don't think there are going to be any real winners, except perhaps certain factions among the Atlanticists. And by that, I mean the gay. Everybody likes to say the gay. I assert that it is the gay, which is the global Anglo-American empire. I will not allow the Brits to slither out from their responsibility for the Atlanticist mess that confronts us, since many of the
Well, Putin blamed the Anglos, didn't he?
Yes, yes. I think he's doing that in part because in terms of the broader world, I think he and any number of Russian propagandists are being very careful not to say things to alienate the American people at this point. So I think it suits him to be able to say that UK has more to do with it at this point, or to be, I think he even said Anglo-Saxons, didn't he? It was something a little bit odd.
Did. Yeah. It was a little bit odd. I wondered if, has this been lost in translation somehow? But I guess a phrase like that is fairly recognizable. It was a strange thing to say, but I agree, it probably was optics. So I think you and I agree about Ukraine, that this is something that is being done to remake the world in a sense, to remake the Western world. It looks like, whether by accident or by design, Europe is going to be severely hit by all of this. And what would you say about that?
Yeah, I believe that's the case. And, you know, I was doing the usual thing of saying, well, you know, Russians have more artillery. They're bringing more artillery to bear. They're able to fire more artillery rounds. You know, I'm looking at the fact that they can get their men and materiel to the front through a less circuitous route than NATO is forced to take in some respects. And, you know, that the fact that they've got a larger pool of manpower and all these sorts of things. So everybody's argued these points back and forth, right? So I'm not going to get into the big thing of saying, no, I'm right because, right? I don't care if anyone viewing this imagines that Ukraine is going to win. I fully acknowledge that it's possible they can, certainly, because Russia is not just fighting Ukraine. And even if they were just fighting Ukraine, you know, anything can happen in many respects. You know, if they had a brilliant enough general, or they hit it early enough, you know, there are angles that could be taken, you know, or ways that all of this could be construed where we could imagine that Ukraine could win. And it's still possible that they can win with the backing that they have. I don't think they will. And I don't want to argue those points. What's more interesting for me is an angle that sort of recently came up. I'm going to be talking about it tomorrow night. And, you know, short of some kind of force majeure, with Prudentialist and Charlemagne, two of my friends. Certainly don't, if you're going to be watching Millennial, don't come watch my stream until later. Watch Millennial. And both of those guys have their own insights and have been looking into this themselves. So, you know, tune in tomorrow if you want to hear more details about it, or after the fact, as I was saying. Because it'll stay up. But and each of those guys is going to bring their own insights to the table. There's probably stuff that I'm missing. But in terms of the general picture, this is it. I was sitting there thinking to myself, wow, Three-C's Initiative. Three-C's Initiative is something that you'll hear about if you follow Eastern European politics and investment. There are different angles on this of basically bringing together the Eastern European countries in a block. Overlapping to some extent, actually, with Central European ones, depending on which version of this is being floated, right? These are all much older ideas, which we'll get into in a minute. But you'll hear about a thing called the Three C's Initiative, which is about, you know, basically Eastern European and potentially some Central European states getting together and working in concert to have one sort of economic bloc that has access to the Baltic, to the Black Sea, and to the Mediterranean via the Adriatic. So you can imagine that would be, you know, places like the Baltics up there, and the Black Sea coast via Ukraine. Although conceivably it could be done with Romania, Bulgaria, and these other countries. Ukraine isn't the only country with coastline there. And then the Croatia or Montenegro, you know, these countries that have access to the Adriatic. And I was looking at that and I was thinking to myself, you know, I remember I did things about, you know, Poland strong, right? And I'd have pictures of winged hussars on the videos. And I was like, yeah, right on, man. You know, these based Eastern European countries are, you know, tearing it up. While meanwhile, you know, the Western Europe is totally overwhelmed by the PAS and all the rest. And of course, over time, you know, even an American will eventually begin to understand that no, Orban isn't based in every way. No, the Polish government isn't really based in every way. But still, it was in my mind that these are people who are kind of standing up for themselves, you know, and saying no to a lot of these things, and when and where they can, you know, pushing back. And so for me, it was rather strange. I was sitting there thinking about a Three Seas Initiative, and I posted this tweet saying, the Three Seas Initiative is simply designed to block Russian access to Three Seas. Change my mind. You know, because it just came to me. It was like, there's something a little suspicious here. You know, we know that the PAS will absolutely back right-wing movements. There's no question about it when it suits them. But I just kind of threw it out there. I had this niggling suspicion. And somebody got back real quick and he's like, yeah, Prometheanism. And I'm like, huh? You know, I'd heard about Three Seas Initiative. I'd heard about even older ideas of Intermarium, which your guest Morgan was talking about, right? Which is the idea that it's between seas. Intermarium is the idea that it's between seas, and that has more to do with a political strategy centered around Poland. And Three Seas Initiative is sort of something that in the Venn diagram overlaps quite a bit with that, but has to do more with economic development. But that economic development having to do with building infrastructure and energy cooperation, you know, those things at the end of the day become fundamentally military things as well, you know? So I was like, wow, that's interesting. Wow, Prometheanism. And so I go look, and it emerges. There's this, and I'm going to get myself into all kinds of trouble here, because I'm not from Poland. I'm not from Eastern Europe. I'm not a master of this subject. And this is a subject that, you know, has quite a bit to do with various important events in the 20th century, World War I, World War II, and particularly on the right and in these odd circles, you've got people who are like uber fucking autists about World War II and all the rest. So I'm just telling you up front, I'm not a master of this subject. There will doubtless be aspects that I don't fully get. I'm still learning about it. So if you want to come in and, you know, spank me with actually, you know, please be gentle about it. But it emerges that this idea of Intermarium comes out of the period immediately following World War I, when I believe it's with the Treaty of Versailles, Poland is reestablished. I think that makes it the second Polish Republic, right? And there's this leader in Poland who's famous for defending this new emerging Polish entity against the Soviets when they come in. Maybe it's the hero of the Vistula. I can't remember, but the dude's name is Piłsudski. There's some kind of L that I think works like a double L in Spanish as a Y. So people will say Piłsudski, but it's Piłsudski. What's all this then?
Yeah. It's very annoying. But I thought you were a linguist. I thought you knew about this stuff.
Ah, fuck off. No, I'm not. I have not these powers. And I'm not a linguist. I've never been a linguist. I'm a semiotician, my friend. My focus is on non-linguistic signification. That is sets me apart. This is why my brain is so fucking big that I use it as a chair, because linguists don't even know how to deal with me. But coming back to this point, there's this hero, this Polish hero, and he kind of works behind the scenes as a politician and doesn't really move front and center totally until rather late in his career in the 30s or late 20s, somewhere in there. Again, this isn't my field, but this guy, Piłsudski, is a Pole, and he's a Polish patriot, and he wants to establish his country and to regain some of the glory of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and all this stuff. Again, this is immediately following World War One, and he gets strong backing from the French, and we can only imagine that he had strong backing from the Brits, because not too many years later, there was a World War II that started, and it was triggered because all these Western countries, like, you know, Britain and the rest, had given guarantees that they would defend Poland. So anyway, Piłsudski comes along and he says, well, what am I going to do? I've got the Germans on one side and I've got the Russians on the other. You notice how these characters look kind of similar? You know how you got Germany, the powerhouse that has to have its gas cut off and needs to be deindustrialized today so it doesn't get too powerful in the EU and NATO can continue to manage things. And you know how you got Russia on the other side? It turns out, wacky, crazy, that these same fundamental elements were in play back in the day. And so Germany on one side was a big threat to Poland.
That is a thing. You know, this is something that came up this year. When, you know, we can Nord Stream and all that. Bloody hell, how much he... Right.
It's a small drink.
All right, I'll try not to overreact.
Look at how big the ice cube is. Can you see how big that ice cube is? There's no room in there for whiskey.
Ah, you're right. Okay, I'll take your word for it. Yeah, this fact about Russia and Germany and trying to separate them, this imperative that they must not get together. They must not have a working relationship. It was weird to see this emerging, this re-emerging this year, because, of course, it is something that's been a thing for so long. And, of course, it goes back to... both world wars, I guess.
And a dude named Mackinder who considered Eurasia the world island at the center, and it was so valuable and so strategically important, especially for a land-based military might, that you could think of it as like ancient Sparta, right? Whereas the Athenians with their navy, right, or the Brits, you know, an island nation with a great navy, the Americans as the inheritors of this, the global police force with aircraft carriers, right? So if you look at it like Spartans versus the sea powers, or the sea powers versus the land power, which is the world island, according to Mackinder, there's a clear strategic imperative to ensure that not one party comes to dominate it. And so for a time, they were concerned that the Germans might do that. And so they backed the commies. After that, there's the Cold War. So in some respects, we backed, very quietly backed the Chinese so that there'd be two powers over there, in the nether eastern regions. And then more recently, we've seen, the technical expertise and the trained populations that weren't just recently dragged out of the 13th century, like a lot of Russian Slavs were under the auspices of Stalin, right? We've been concerned about those groups connecting, because if you get German and Dutch know-how and that sort of thing, but it's combined with Russian natural resources, gas, uranium, manganese, forests that have never heard the sound of an axe, you could have a real problem. So yes, not to cut you off, but that's the primary point. It goes back much further than World War One, but it's a strategic concern, and apparently it's been an imperative for quite some time.
So then why did this happen now? And I know that it goes back to at least 2014, probably well before that. But why now?
Well, let's back up to the history a little bit more, right? So Piłsudski is confronted with the Germans on one side and the Russians on the other. And so he decides that he's, because Poland is brand new and they're not fully established at this point, you know, and they've got their own fighting going on. You want to talk about people getting dragged out of, you know, the 13th century. You know, Western Poland was more developed, but Eastern Poland wasn't. And they were previously split up. They were part of three empires. So the first thing you have to understand is that after World War II, Poland was created by the Western powers as a way to just break up the previous understanding of things so that they would always have a lever to pull it and cause it to disintegrate or to be able to create problems. It's just like Kurdistan. Kurdistan was divided up in the territories of Iran and more than this, but mainly Iran, Turkey, and Syria. So if they ever want to destabilize Iran, Turkey, or Syria, they just pull the Kurdish lever. Likewise, they got rid of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Russian Empire and the Reich, and they plopped Poland into place to just basically be a burr under the saddle, right? A wrench in the works. Now, of course, the Poles have their own history. I'm not saying they were invented ab nihilo, right? There's a Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. They have their own long history. They have their own language. They have their own culture. I'm not pretending that stuff didn't exist. But it's incumbent upon all of us to recognize that those historical facts, I believe, were exploited by Western powers because it suited them. And so what happens? You say, why is this happening again today? Well, let's first realize that Poland was put there by the victorious Allies to ensure that Russia and Germany wouldn't get together and that they'd have a way to kind of cut off that connection. Right? And Piłsudski said, we're going to take this middle ground because we're not powerful yet. We're not going to piss off the Russians. We're not going to piss off the Germans. We're going to cleave to the middle, and we're not going to commit to one side or the other because that would cause the other side to want to destroy us, and we're too weak at this point. So you know what's weird? It's just wild and crazy. The Soviets and the Germans, the mid-century Germans, were kind of making signs like they would do some things together. And eventually, of course, we know what happened. They ended up fighting. But early on, it looked like, you know, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and everything else. What's the first thing that the Russians and the Germans did? They went whoop, straight in, split Poland, and said, fuck a bunch of this Poland shit. I'm taking half. You take half. This is a problem, and we want it gone. That's the first thing they did. And doing that caused World War II to break out, at least in Europe, as far as I understand it. Yeah, you can say that they moved into Czech dominions and did stuff with the Austrians, right? But the red line that nobody was supposed to cross was getting rid of Poland. And you know what's so strange? The Germans and the Russians both wanted to do it. Wacky. I almost see some parallels. And you know what's so crazy? The Brits didn't want them to.
I'm reminded of Zelensky's comment that Ukraine after the war is going to be a sort of police state because they're going to have like men at supermarkets with guns in order to hold the thing together. It seems to be reminiscent of this, where you've got a situation that there's a situation with an obvious solution, but instead of doing that, you will maintain this situation indefinitely at great effort, when it's just going to be a thorn in people's side, basically.
Well, that's the idea of a frozen conflict. And we can see that everybody uses that to great ends. It's quite effective. The Russians use it all the time. We love it. Anybody will use it because it basically means I can't fully control you, but I can create so much of a mess that you can never fully come on as a stable, civilized country that people can safely invest in with the rule of law, because here's a frozen conflict and I can pull the lever on it to rattle it and make a mess with it. Right? It's similar to the way that the United States uses Israel in the Middle East as this boogeyman. They just pull it out like a Punch and Judy puppet or something. And it's like, oh my God, the Arabs all freak out and they get all disorganized and then they can't think about doing anything in their own country. Yeah. So frozen conflicts work that way. Thing is, Ukraine, you have to understand, the word itself literally means, Ukraine literally means borderland. The name of the country is something like marches or margins or borders. The name of the country, and they want to hammer into our heads this ancient country of Ukraine and its ethnos. Ukraine doesn't have an ethnos in that sense. It's been a plaything of major powers since the time of the Turks. Every major imperial power, the Austro-Hungarians, Turks early on, but they got pushed out, the Russian Empire, the Germans, everybody has come in there and agitated to create their own factions. So in the West, they're more Catholic, and you've got, I don't even remember all the names of the country, but places like Ruthenia and Galicia, right? Those places have been agitated for a long time to be pro-Ukraine. We have an ethnic identity, right? The other half of the country really does see itself in large part as Russian. You got mixed groups, right? Kiev is the old place of the Kievan Rus, the Rurikid dynasty, right? Odessa was set up, as many people like to talk about, by, Potemkin, maybe? I can't remember. It was set up under Catherine the Great, though, I think. So basically, it's a borderland. masquerading, I'm going to catch hell for this. I'm going to catch so much hell for this, masquerading as a nation. And you've got people in the western part of Ukraine who are absolutely ferocious. They're like, we are Ukrainians. Believe me, they'll tell you they're Ukrainians. You've got them in the east saying, no, we got this Russian background. Meanwhile, these Ukrainians who are being helped by the Poles at present would be happy to slit their throats 70 years ago, right? 80 years ago. Meanwhile, the Poles who are helping the Ukrainians also used to control part of those territories and would be very, very happy to get them back. People in the West, they go, oh, it's Ukraine. It's a nation. We don't want their ethnos to disappear. It's a fiction along the lines, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing. France is a fiction with its internal divisions, right? Like, go talk to somebody from the Vendée, talk to somebody from Brittany, right? The United Kingdom of Great Britain, Scotland, and Ireland, and all this stuff, Wales, and the rest. Northern Ireland, excuse me, is a fiction after a fashion.
Even Edinburgh versus Glasgow.
Well, yeah. Indeed, you can. It's like there's no Baptist sect too small not to schism yet again. Right.
Yeah.
So, but basically, Ukraine is a borderland area, and the great powers have been dealing with it for a long time. But let's come back to Pilsudski, Pilsudski. This guy said he put together a doctrine called Prometheanism, and the idea is that for Poland to survive, it must pursue a strategy of peeling off former possessions of the Russian Empire, or, you know, in the later context, the Soviets, because he didn't distinguish a great deal there. He said you have to peel off these former regions that were under the control of the Russians or Soviets, and you're going to do two things thereby. You're going to weaken the Russians or Soviets thereby, because they'll then lose that, right? But we're not just going to weaken them thereby. We're going to spin them up, turn them around, and make them go fight the Russians. So they'll turn what used to be in the black column into the red column. They'll take an asset and they'll convert it to a liability as a distinct strategy. And they did this, for example, with the... I'm not going to go down that road. They did it with intelligence services to a considerable extent, with the support of other countries, and they attempted to peel off countries like Georgia from Russia. They particularly had their eyes on Belarus. But if you go look at Prometheanism, the core idea is that the future of Poland and its security depends upon peeling Ukraine off of Russia and allying with it. It's absolutely central. You can go look at document after document from Pilsudski, and he talks about how critical Ukraine is for this process and for this strategy. And so you see Pilsudski setting forth these basic ideas. I don't want to hang too much there, but you will have seen recently, you had the Euromaidan stuff, right, in 2014. And Soros is all over that. You know what else Soros was all over? He was all over Georgia previously. And then Georgia got nipped in the bud when the Russians came down and took South Ossetia. South Ossetia was basically, it's not exactly the old Georgian military highway, but there's now a Transcaucasian highway. Basically, the North-South Pass that's strategically critical through the middle of the Caucasus exits in the south through South Ossetia. So Russia basically said, screw this stuff, the games that are being played trying to peel Georgia away. We're going to send our troops down into South Ossetia to secure this opening in the southern wall of the Caucasus, which is like a sort of a fortress wall in Russia's mind for its own defense. Ukraine is likewise very, very important for Russia. If you take a look at it from an operational level, Jimmy Thomas has a great clip on a series of clips on looking at the Ukraine war from an operational level. Basically, once you get over into the region of Ukraine, particularly eastern Ukraine, it's just more or less open land. Yeah, you got to ford some rivers, but you can roll right up to the ring road around Moscow with division level groupings of military. They don't have major land barriers. It's the same problem that's plagued Poland for centuries. People can just cruise back and forth across it because they don't have a great deal of natural barriers. So the southern wall of the Caucasus, South Ossetia, Georgia, that's critical to Russia. Pilsudski, under Prometheanism, said we got to peel Georgia off. They talked about how they need to peel Central Asia off. But particularly, they always, the jewel in the crown for the Promethean strategy was to peel Ukraine off, because that would push Russia further back and make them more an Asian power rather than a Eurasian power. And they're also heavily focused on Belarus, this area. And you know what's crazy? This is what I started to say. You had the South Ossetia stuff in 2008. Weird. It's almost like a pattern begins to emerge. Then in 2014, you have Euromaidan, which just has color revolution Soros shit all over it. I mean, it literally, as it slobbers and stumbles about, it drips off bits of Soros. It drips off bits of color revolution. Then what follows? It's rather odd. 2014, 2015 in Poland, Andrzej Duda appears out of nowhere. Go look at the information on the Polish elections. It's just wacky. It's wild. It's crazy. Nobody expected me. He's like just appeared out of nowhere. Against all expectations, you'll see headlines. Andrzej Duda appeared from nowhere with his Justice and Freedom Party, this right-wing party. The incumbent who is expected to take office didn't. Oh, well, wacky. And what does Duda do? He turns around immediately and works out all kinds of major deals for arms and NATO cooperation and interest and military investment from the United States. Like, that must be a coincidence. Must just be a coincidence. And then what happened shortly after that, right around 2020, you see all kinds of stuff going on with attempted color revolutions in Belarus. Weird. Must just be a coincidence. Crazy like that. And then Belarus gets pissed off about it and starts pushing migrants over the border into Poland. Almost like Belarus and Poland got some kind of static going on. Almost like Poland is sort of a front man for a U.S. operation straight down that central area that used to be filed under the name Intermarium or Three Seas Initiative or this block. And so that's what I was thinking about. That's what I was suspicious of. Poland strong. Why is it that we have these Eastern European countries and we're all supposed to be like, yeah, man, they're just standing against the paws, man. They're just not going to take that. No. In my view, it suits the West to inflame this type of nationalism because you can wind a bunch of Slavs up and get them killing each other. You know, Catholic Slavs fighting against Orthodox Slavs. You know, Ukrainian Patriarchate, Orthodox Slavs versus Russian Patriarch. Look at what they did with Yugoslavia. Now, we're all supposed to be totally against nationalism. They're perfectly happy, even with the echoes of Ustasha, they were perfectly happy to wind up the Croats and get them fighting Serbs and get them fighting Croats. They could break them up into separate nations and begin to pull them in. So it suits us to have huge parades in Poland with lots of red flares and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the street. It suits us. Man, as soon as I went down this rabbit hole, I'm like, wow, you know, it's really weird how Usyk just sort of rose up to the surface as a Ukrainian boxer, you know, that everybody's supposed to look at because the Ukrainians, they just produce great boxers. Wow, Lomachenko, and I'll grant you, the man has amazing talent, in large part because he used to be a dancer. Lomachenko. Wow. Suddenly you got Lomachenko, you got Usyk, you got these great Ukrainian fighters. It must just be a coincidence that they all got brought over to the West and they even do things like wear proper Ukrainian folk shirts with the embroidery on them. And Usyk will come with sort of like a Cossack style, Hetman style, like forelock on his head. And they get to be these beautiful icons of the plucky Ukrainians who are natural born fighters, whose boxers lay their opponents low. In the West, we do this. We are perfectly willing and able to wind up nationalist groups to serve our ends. I'm not saying we created it out of whole cloth. I'm not saying that Poland doesn't have a right to exist. I'm not saying even that the Ukrainians don't have a right to kill themselves serving the interests of the United States because they believe it serves their own. Right? It's their choice if they want to be the rent boy for the United States rather than the rent boy for Russia. Everybody has that choice. And under the United States, in theory, they'll be able to develop their own military to a considerable extent and do so. Poland certainly is going to be in a better position after having gotten the investment. At least they've got the weapons, right? That's how they, as nationalists concerned about their future of their country, have to think about it. But anyway, the picture for me that emerged is Prometheanism, Intermarium, and this shit continues. You can go track it through Brzezinski, who was in the Carter administration. There's a couple guys later who ended up being there. They basically left Poland and went to the United States and carried a lot of these Promethean ideas in terms of foreign policy into the U.S. And depending on who you read, they met with warmer or colder receptions. But the reality is, we can see it going on. The United States is and allied powers are had been working to peel off Belarus, to peel off Ukraine, to peel off Georgia, to peel off every single former satellite country, and where necessary, wind them up and turn them back at Russia. So, yeah, I could go on about this for a long time, but it's probably best if I stop there as an encapsulated thing and see if it makes sense. And if you have any questions, you know, perhaps I can answer them.
So to, not to summarize it, but to ask a key question, what you're saying is that a strategy devised by a Polish nobleman, a Polish statesman, Piłsudski, in the 1930s, has now been utilized by America. Is that what you're saying? Oh, you're muted. No, you're muted.
Yeah. Sorry. Yes, but I'm saying that we also are seeing the same thing play out to a certain extent that happened with World War II. I'm also saying
that. Well, indeed, and that's why don't you outline that? What are the similarities between this conflict and the start of World War II?
Just basically that Ukraine has existed as a nation in a modern sense for about 30 years. It appears at the beginning of the 90s. They tried, after the Tsarist government fell and Russia collapsed, they tried to establish themselves. And because their name means borderland, and because none of the surrounding powers would tolerate it, they rolled that up quick. Ukraine didn't even have as much time as Poland did to establish itself. And indeed, Poland was more of a country historically. Ukraine was always a borderland. That's why its fucking name means borderland. So what happens is these powers, they don't want Ukraine coming online that way, but they can't stop Poland. The victorious allied powers, Russia can't have a vote in the matter. The Soviets tried to send in troops and they got back the fuck off by Piłsudski, among others, right? And right around this same time, if you look into your history with Wrangel, when he's driven down into Crimea and everything else, for a time, it looks like the Red Army is going to take him over. But then the Poles appear out of nowhere, backed by the British, and they start pushing back the Soviets, and they're looking like they're doing real well. And the problem is the Poles want to work with the Ukrainians and extend themselves into that area. The Red Army comes in and makes short work of that. And the Brits say, well, you know, we got Poland here. Let's not get messed up in this whole thing with Ukraine. We're going to withdraw our support for Wrangel. And we're probably just going to tap the Poles on the shoulder here and say, be realistic. Let's focus on the country you've got. You can't deal with all this territory. You know, just, you know, 10 years ago, you had Makhnovists rolling around in Tachankas or whatever. So basically, they were forced to be realistic about all of this. But the main point to understand is that the Western powers, the Anglo-Atlanticist powers, throw in France, right? They're on the Atlantic coast. They have their problems with Britain, but, you know, in this respect, they more or less cooperated. Depending on who you ask, you know, they'll talk about how France was a big backer of Poland, but I tend to think, I haven't looked into it enough yet, that the UK was too. The point is that after World War I, when they were in a position to impose such things, when Russia was weak, because they were dealing with their own civil war, following the revolution, the early 20s, the late teens, early 20s, they established this country that would basically sit there right in between and get in the way of Germany and Russia ever doing anything like that together. And it fit with the ideas of Mackinder, which is don't let them take over the world island. And then the first thing that happens when somebody like Mustache Man comes back, right, the kind of guy who thinks to himself, you know, let's make him sign it in the same damn train car, right? That kind of guy, you know. And then you got Stalin over on the other side, right, who has his own ideas for how he'd like to see Eastern Europe turn out. Those two guys, what can they agree on? Let's not go over the many, many things they don't agree on. The one thing they could agree on was get the fuck rid of Poland. Screw this shit that the Western powers plugged right into the middle of our world in order to keep us at loggerheads or divide us, to prevent us from ever not being, how shall we say, something like a frozen conflict on a grand scale.
Yeah.
That's interesting to me. And now what do we see? It's Poland following the Promethean program of peeling off Ukraine. The United States is helping them. It works out great for them because, you know, Ukrainians are going to be more or less as warlike, more or less as able to endure cold as Russians. And they have the added advantage in some respects of fighting for their homeland. Now, of course, that applies to the ones over in the Donbass as well, right? What we're really dealing with is a kind of civil war backed by two powers. And the United States is ultimately going to be the main winner because it's going to keep Germany weak. It's going to push them towards deindustrialization. It's going to push them back from having as strong a seat at the table. It's going to push Russia back so it can't sell oil and natural gas as readily and as profitably as easily to the further western reaches of Europe. It's basically a move to, as John Morgan was talking about, he said, well, it'll just be a pivot and Russia will turn eastwards, right? But this is also basically just cutting them out of Europe and cutting off their access to the Black Sea as well.
Yeah, I mean, it retards the natural economic ecosystem that would emerge in Europe. And
it keeps Europe deprived of resources. And the only way that resources can come in quantity, you know, the European navies can, you know, take care of covering supply of stuff coming in across the Mediterranean. But, you know, writ large, it means that more and more stuff is going to have to come in by sea. And who controls the seas?
Yeah, indeed. This is a... And it's a sort of intervention by America to fuck up Europe. I mean,
but with the absolute willing participation of a large number of the Poles. The Poles have their own factions and divisions, but the Poles they're central in this.
Well,
they couldn't do it without the U.S., but they wanted to do it before the U.S. ever told them about it. I mean, they came up with the damn idea. You know,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
That didn't come out right, but yeah.
Well, another weird, really perverse layer to all of this is that I heard that German people saying just after Nord Stream was damaged, German people said they're like on our in the movement were saying that German politicians will be celebrating this because it means that the I mean, I find that incredible that they'll be. I think the idea was that German politicians who are establishment or really plugged into the gay will celebrate this because it means that that situation can continue. Whereas otherwise they would perhaps be pushed towards a whole new situation, a whole new working relationship with Russia. That's now been nixed.
Yeah, I don't know enough about the domestic divisions within Germany of attitudes for and against Russia. I know that it's going to hammer on German industry because you can't bring enough LNG tankers over to keep it running. I will say that it seems to me that a part of this program was simply to bring in another source of energy that didn't give Russia a whip hand, which was Black Sea energy. And pipelines coming in from the Black Sea region, things like the gas fields in the eastern and southern Mediterranean that were supposed to come in through Greece and Italy. And I also believe that basically Turkey was running around with a bunch of ships in the eastern Mediterranean, getting all pissed off that Cyprus and Israel and Greece were cutting deals, and they wanted to find their own big deposits of natural gas. And then suddenly they got real quiet about it a little bit before the war in Ukraine started. And at the same time, they started providing drones and other tech to Ukraine. I wonder if that has anything to do with Black Sea natural gas and the strength of the Turkish Navy in the Black Sea and the idea that pipelines could come in through the Ukrainian coast, or if needs be, they could come in through Romania, where NATO has, you know, basically made it the the seat of their Black Sea Command. They've invested heavily in Romania. I think basically that there was enough energy that they had hoped to bring out of the Eastern Mediterranean and the Black Sea, and that they could have brought it in through Ukraine, that they could basically tell Russia to go suck a fart and continue to have the energy that they need to keep things running. And the issue now is that Russia came in and said, no, I don't think so. I think we'll take back Crimea, which I want to remind everybody is basically Sevastopol. You know, that's where we had the Crimean War, the first time that France and Britain allied with the Turks in order to push the Russians back in the 1850s over that same little spit of land. That's the center of all the Black Sea naval operations for the Russian Navy. Russia continues to hold that, and it has the land bridge to Crimea now, which means it continues to be able to assert itself in the Black Sea. And it's in a position where it could in future, right now it's, you know, the issue is in question, but it could in future threaten Odessa. And so that would cut off the ability of energy to come in from the Black Sea and roll the rest of the way up into Europe.
Fucking hell. Geopolitics really is, it's like spaghetti, you know. I guess your brain is optimized for this, and mine definitely isn't. And I struggle to hold in my head all of these different factors and different relationships between places. It's
let me throw in this last piece.
Oh,
just the last piece. You're hearing about the crazy stuff going on with Serbia now and Kosovo and how the Serbs might send in their own troops to be peacekeeping forces. Remember that Vladimir Putin came into power by sending paratroopers into Belgrade to stop things that NATO was doing in Belgrade once upon a time. That's what sort of ticked things over the line and brought Putin onto the scene in the first place. And now we're seeing stuff flare up in Serbia again. And guess what's happened? They've basically cut off Serbia's access to anything. Montenegro has been sort of dragged over onto the NATO side, and whoever needed to be paid off has been paid off, which kind of cuts off most of Serbia's access to the Adriatic. And meanwhile, you got people like Alex Soros doing editorials, paid editorials in the New York Times about how it's time for the EU to come in and bring in the Balkans, right? Basically, they're trying to cut out this whole swath, and their Three Seas Initiative, as I had first imagined, would include access to the Adriatic as well, which is where you then have the issue of Serbia with its historical ties to Russia. Well, guess what, Serbia? The EU and NATO are telling you, you can't have those ties anymore. We're going to cut them off. And we'll isolate you as necessary until you come online. Serbia is, of course, really critical because it's part of the course of the Danube that then runs out to the Black Sea. And it's a major conduit for energy and all sorts of other riverborne shipping. It goes all the way up into Germany. And in around Mainz, it connects with a bunch of canals and then comes out at the damn North Sea. It's basically a major canal system that runs all the way down through Europe, then through Serbia, countries like Hungary, through Romania, and comes out right at the sea. All of that's supposed to be cut off because we want to roll it up. I think there's something going on where the United States is going to put together this Three Seas Initiative intermarium thing with Poland as an anchor in terms of its military. And they had hoped it would be Poland and Ukraine as a really powerful duo. And then they would pull in these other, the Baltic states would come right the fuck along. They're like, give me any excuse to tell Russia to fuck off and we'll come along, right? You might be able to pull over places like Slovakia or Czech Republic, right? We'll see Hungary's being very careful to be neutral, but it needs to be neutral in both directions, right? But basically the idea is to bring this whole block in. And what do you have? You have countries where you've encouraged nationalism in Eastern Europe because you want them to feel nationalist. You want them to be willing to push back. Look at how Poland is being encouraged to yell at Germany about how they want reparations and everything, right? Poland strong, right? Screw the Germans, you know, screw the Russians. And at the same time, get all these Slavic countries to feel nationalistic, give them military support from the U.S., and meanwhile, flood Western Europe with whatever you can find south of the Sahara, right? And what you have is a group of Western Europeans who really aren't in a position to do anything about anything except occasionally whinge, you know. And then you have a block of Slavic countries that have been allowed to remain more heterogeneous because it suits your purposes to make them nationalistic and more aggressive against countries like Russia. And it forms a band running all the way from the Baltic, all the way down to the Black Sea and Adriatic, cuts Russia out of all of those places. You see, what's important to understand is that this move, if I understand any of it correctly, and I don't know, this is all new shit for me, but it seems like a way equally to screw Western Europe. Because you cut them off from those resources and you have a group of people who are allowed to remain homogenous for a time. And so they can do things that you can't anymore because your countries have been diversified. Sorry, that was the last point I wanted to put in there. And it includes Serbia, Montenegro. Look at those areas too, because that's the third sea. And if I have any understanding of this properly, that region bears on this as well.
So what would you say to someone who's a nationalist and said something like the following? Ukraine, as you said, that nationalist sentiment has been encouraged in these countries. So what would you say to someone who said the following? Ukrainian nationalists, you know, far-right nationalists, will win this war, and then they'll take control of Ukraine, and then there'll be a far-right state in Eastern Europe.
I think a lot of these points were covered by Morgan, who has, you know, sort of experience having gone there and talked to the people, which I don't. From his perspective, as I understand it, you know, that prospect seems rather unlikely. And I'll take it a step further.
Yeah, but I'm asking you because it pertains. I think that what you've been saying sheds light on this whole thing, this whole prospect. America is allowing nationalist sentiment because that serves its purposes. But a far-right state in Eastern Europe that has a sense of itself and has power, that doesn't serve America's interests. Therefore, people like the Azov Battalion, who are currently being lauded and celebrated and lionized in Ukraine, I don't think they're going to be allowed to gain power, any real power.
I don't think so either.
After this war, I think that America will make damn sure that they might be the first ones against the wall. You know,
well, I asked a few polls about this. Again, this is not my area of specialization. I don't claim any special knowledge. I claim an ability to look at things differently, which I'll warn everybody at the outset is pretty much 50-50. It's pretty much as often wrong as it is right. So your mileage may vary. You know, go think about this yourself, and maybe you'll discover that there are aspects of this that are. I've been enormously, dramatically wrong before, right? But what I do claim is a willingness. You know, I'm not concerned, like Frody's point before. I understand where he's coming from, you know, where he's like, you know, it removes our credibility. I don't care about that shit. I don't think we know anything about anything. We're so thoroughly lied to that we have to go back and create a whole category of people called revisionists to rewrite our fucking history because we've discovered 90% of it is just bald-faced lies. You know, how are we expected to know whether COVID is this or that or what these people are doing is this or that? Everything is so vitiated that the signal is the noise. The noise is the signal. So I don't care about the thing of trying to clearly, I don't care about the thing of trying to cling to respectability or authority or, you know, not to seem as though I'm flying off the handle. I want to look at it in my own particular way, and I find the most reward from that. And from that perspective, I would say, man, it looks like, well, what did I start to tell you? I talked to some people from Poland, and they're like, man, you got to understand this justice and whatever party is not really based. They're bringing in all kinds of ridiculous crap, right? And we've certainly seen, look at Zelensky himself, Does he like augur well for a base future?
Exactly. I mean, yeah, we don't even need to go into that really, but I mean,
so they've wound up the best and brightest.
Yeah. Sorry. Go on.
Oh, I didn't mean to cut you off. Basically, they've wound up the best and brightest or the most bellicose, and they sent them into the damn meat grinder. That's what they always do. So, you know, yeah, maybe they'll have a right-wing state in the future, but I don't think the odds are good. They'll maintain the amount of it necessary to create this band, I believe. And, you know, some of the other guys, like I said, Prude knows further stuff about this, Prudentialist. He's been looking at some things. He knows more about U.S. policy. He knows more about the geostrategy wonks. Charlemagne's been looking into it closely and has brought other insights about the kind of investment that's being done under the Three Seas Initiative, which seems to not quite be the intermarium. It's another way to do it economically. But the idea is to set up this group of states. And I think even other arrangements or ways of playing with this, they're like competing. So if you look at the V4, the Visegrad 4, right, that's another angle people are trying to take on it. Each one of the powers is trying to influence it and own it. But at the end of the day, I don't see any prospect. I mean, you know, they made you. Like, that's what I would say to a poll. They made you. They brought the weapons in. They're backing you. They installed the government. You know, to some extent, you agree with them because your interests seem to align. But I mean, look what the hell happened to Poland last time. Look what happened to Poland that everybody fought for. I mean, this is, it's almost a cliche. You know, everybody knows this. The red line that nobody was supposed to cross was, you know, the destruction of Poland as a state. What did the West do about that when World War II ended? Where were they then? Where was Polish independence then?
Well, absolutely. Like, you know, this gives the lie to the whole thing about World War II. That in the end, supposedly Britain went to war to protect Polish independence, and then at the end of the war, Poland was taken over by the Soviets. So yeah. That's a ridiculous situation for if the whole point of the war. obviously it's ridiculous.
Well, if I were a Ukrainian, I'd be pissed because basically this is serving Polish interests without a bunch of Polish troops having to die, except the ones who want to volunteer. Because believe me, there are shit cans full of mercenaries in Ukraine right now fighting on behalf of the West. Also fighting on behalf of Russia. I'm not saying it's a one-sided thing. But, you know, Poland is having to dump resources into this and to some extent manpower. But remember, as I told you before, it's not like unimaginable for Poles and Ukrainians to cut each other's throats. So this right now is really serving Polish interests and even more so serving U.S. interests. The one group that's kind of getting fucked out of its peaches is Ukraine. Their kids are just dying by the thousands, you know. You know, I guess it has its moments. You do build up, you know, knowledge of war that you'll be able to pass on to the next generation that, you know, attenuated populations further west won't have. You'll have that know-how in your culture. You'll have that living memory of being willing to fight. And all wars, probably. I don't know if there's any war that couldn't be taken apart in the way I'm doing this one and revealed as a travesty. You know, it's how the rich get richer and the poor get youngins. And, you know, long trench graves with bodies bulldozed into them get filled. So, you know, in that sense, I guess if that's what you want to do, knock yourself out. But to me, it just looks like an absolutely nauseating travesty.
And also, you said at the start that you think Russia will win this war. So that's another angle here, because saying
that's odds. That's odds, just to be clear. I mean, they lose too.
Yeah. Of course, I'm not saying it's an absolute cast iron prediction or whatever. I'm just
I suck at those.
That's understood. But then in that case, well, what is the West? What is America actually? Let's assume you're right. Let's assume that is what happens and Russia wins. Then then that idea of the band of countries blocking Russia from Western Europe is...
No, it doesn't go away. It doesn't go away. I don't think that Russia is going to be able to take all of Ukraine. I mean, the most outrageous, optimistic scenario anybody could imagine would be, you know, they get Odessa, they link up with Transnistria, and they take the areas east of the Dnieper River. That's the most radically optimistic vision anybody could have. So even if they do, guess what happens? The U.S. can still assert itself through Romania to get at Black Sea natural gas, although some of the best gas fields might be within the territorial waters of Ukraine, as we might discover. And if the Russia takes all the coastline, then we'll just have to see. And Georgia will become much more interesting at that point. But leave that aside. Basically, Russia will still have Crimea. It will have a strong role in the Black Sea, but it won't be the only player there because NATO is present. It's, as I said, Romania's Black Sea center of operations for NATO. And Turkey has a navy that's, I haven't compared it on paper recently, but it's got to be more or less as impressive as whatever Russia has in the Black Sea. It's not like either of them are, you know, it's not like that's... it's not like they have huge navies there, but Turkey is a real naval power and does have real force projection capabilities in terms of navy in the Black Sea. So NATO's there. Turkey's there. Turkey's a NATO player. If Russia can't peel Turkey off, which it's trying to do now, by the way, and that will probably depend on how things eventuate in Ukraine, you're going to end up with Turkey in the Black Sea, U.S. with Romania. At that point, they'll probably push harder to rein Bulgaria in. It's slipping out of their grasp right now. Russia seems to be doing well there. But anyway, the point is they'll still have a foothold and on the Black Sea on its western side. Basically, it'll just be a border at the Dnieper River. And they're still going to win because Europe is going to have been forced to pay for all this shit. And they're basically going to own whatever remains of, I mean, just let's just face this now. That's what Morgan was talking about too. No matter how this ends, whatever remains of Ukraine is literally going to be owned by the United States for centuries. It's going to be the bitch of the United States forever. I mean, there's just no way around that.
John and Morgan those predicted 50 years, you're predicting centuries. And yeah, that seems plausible.
I'm being.
I get it. I get it. Ridiculous. But a long time is either way.
But NATO will have been reinvigorated as a thing we all need to do. Cause look at what those nasty Russians did. And all those other countries can still form a band. That's why the next front for this is Serbia. Everybody needs to be watching Serbia because that's the last real Balkan possession that Russia has. And what they've been doing now, there was a thing where Lavrov tried to fly over to Serbia and all the NATO countries said, fuck you, you can't cross our airspace. So the foreign minister of Russia couldn't fly to Serbia, its ally, to have a diplomatic meeting because they've basically been kettled. So that's another thing. And remember that Danube River, it's not a small thing in terms of infrastructure and the amount of business that travels up and down it and how it affects all the countries along its length, which again includes Serbia, Romania. If I'm not screwing up my memory, you go through the Iron Gates, you've got Hungary, you've got Germany. And that river is a central thing with Serbia and also Adriatic access, if it can reconnect to Montenegro. So look at Serbia as well. But to your original point, if Russia quote unquote wins, they'll still have lost money. They'll still have had assets seized. They'll still have lots of dead soldiers. Fewer, I think, than you'll see pushed into ditches in Ukraine, but you know, it's significant. And there will be a new, you know, like people talk about, you know, Cold War II. So it's, and again, it's going to cause all of these remaining countries to say, hey, yeah, we have to link together again. We can't, you know, never again, the crazy Huns from the East that, you know, totally unprovoked attacked our beautiful, ancient nation of Ukraine.
Sorry, I just realized I was typing unmuted there. I thought I was muted. I was just replying to someone in the chat. All right, well, that's a whirlwind tour of a lot of complex geopolitics. Thank you for it. I don't have much to say about it in response. I'm not going to pick apart everything you've said. Well, actually, because it's definitely not my my wheelhouse, but I think I have followed everything you've said, broadly speaking. So with that in mind, let's get to a topic that I might be more able to converse on with you upon, which is the other topic you mentioned to me, the uses and abuses of psychology. Now, and you'd said, I'm bringing it up now because you said it linked with the Ukraine story. So,
no, it linked with another one, which was the idea of ambiguity and the rest of that with signification. Right, right. But yeah, let's leave Ukraine behind. I've already, I just realized once again, I just didn't stop talking. I just talked at you for an hour.
It must be something about me. You know, I think it's
you're so beautiful, Woz. I just,
well, I wasn't saying that, but thank you anyway. I think it's something that I just sort of, people feel comfortable just talking with me. And I don't know if that's good or bad. I'm not sure.
Oh, it's a skill.
On topics where I'm more cognizant, you know, conversant, I don't think I'm passive like that, you know. But when it's something that I don't feel comfortable or competent with, I feel it's best just to let them talk.
And never, you know, stop me.
All right. So go for it then with the uses and abuses of psychology.
Well, this one came to mind as something that I might be able to talk with you about because, and I think we talked about this last year too, you know, when I first saw your channel, it was all about introspection. It was all about who the fuck am I and why did I do that? And, or why didn't I do that? And how is it that I came to be who I am? And am I really aware of what's motivating me?
You know, it's interesting you say that because that was me effectively. I was 31 when I started my channel, and that was me effectively reviewing my life up till that point and trying to make sense of it. And I think I'm not going to say it was all a baffling mystery to me. I think I'd basically, in a lot of ways, come to terms with it. I already understood it, and now I was sort of clarifying it by saying it out loud. But the point is, I could probably now do the whole thing all over again, because that's 8 years ago, and a huge amount of stuff has happened to me in that time. So I could now say, I could now ruminate on, well, what the fuck happened in 2018? And, you know, why was I so stressed in 2018 and 2019? And there are multiple reasons that were going on at that time. But what about the year before? Because I got doxxed the year before. So maybe the stuff that happened in 2018, for example, was a sort of delayed reaction to my life being suddenly changed. I don't know. That's just one example. I mean, there are many things that I wonder about now. You know, I almost want to get away from all of this so that I can cogitate and digest what's happened to me over the last 8 years. But I'm not going to, at least not imminently. But it is, you know, it's like two different lives that I've now had, you know, as a normal person and then as a public figure, a hated public figure. So there's a lot to it. There's a lot to cogitate over there.
But would you say that, because this is kind of where I was going with this, well, I'm trying to find a way to phrase this without making it a leading question, because I'm not good at drawing people out. I'm not a good listener, as you can see. My mouth gets in the way. But I guess what I'm getting at is, would you say that the process that you underwent had value for you?
What do you mean, of the last 8 years?
No, specifically the idea of trying to look inwards to understand your motivations, where you came from, what your life was, to reach.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This is why it's quite difficult for people to, and this is, you know, sounds like self-aggrandizement, but this is why it's quite difficult for people to attack me effectively. It's because I know myself extremely well. And I can answer things. You know, if they accuse me of this or that, I can answer them because I know myself. I know what I was thinking then when I did that thing that they're now trying to pick apart. So self, not basically what I'm getting to here is self-knowledge, I think, is probably, it's just extremely valuable to be able to understand yourself. And I'm not saying I do fully understand myself, but I think I've got a better handle on myself than most people have on themselves. And it's extremely valuable. So yes.
And
and that was the result of years of being at home entombed, as it's a sort of humorous way of saying it, but it basically was entombment. And it was the result of being able to just think about this stuff for years.
And so that's kind of like, you know, as we're setting up the counterpoints here, I don't even want to use that term now because of the fucking shit. As we're looking at the two ways of observing what we're talking about, on the one side, you have the uses of psychology, right? And so over on the uses side, there's self-knowledge, there's understanding. I mean, we could talk for hours, so I'll just quickly just drop it in just to say it about honesty, about self-honesty, about developing that. And if you do have it, I'm not going to say it's easy, but it's yours. And you know when you have to bring it to bear in facing something about yourself, right? If you're somebody like that and you are forced in your life, God help you, to deal with someone who has none of it, then it can be an almost shocking experience. Like you're a fish out of water. You're like, what is this? I don't even know about people like this. I didn't realize someone would lie to them. I mean, everybody lies to themselves. I'm not saying that, but there's a certain type of active self-dishonesty that can be kind of a trip to come across, right? But anyway, the uses of psychology have to do with self-knowledge, the value of honesty with oneself. And it really comes down to the point you just made where, you know, somebody tries to attack you for something and you can turn around, like my old friend used to say, and say, well, if it's true, it's true. And if it ain't, it ain't.
Yeah. That.
And that's what honesty gives you, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now that's.
There's a lot to it. I mean, honesty means that someone isn't going to reveal, if you know yourself already, then someone isn't going to shock you and pull the rug out from under your feet by revealing something about yourself that you didn't know, basically. Mm.
And I've seen you go into the dragon's den quite recently, actually, with honesty as a shield, and basically all the little, you know, hailstones just bounced off. But we don't have to go into that. On the other side, you have the abuses of psychology. And this is really, I'm just sort of setting the stage for what I wanted to ask you about. You know, what the hell do you think about this? Because in terms of a native attitude, I think you and I have that very much in common. Like I would labor. I don't want to put people through it. I don't want to force people to hear most of the bad poetry that resulted from it, or, you know, my moaning and things. But, you know, I went through my own process and continue to at intervals of like, well, fuck, what did I do? And why is this? And what kind of lesson am I trying to teach myself? You know, that's the one side. On the other side, you have the abuses of psychology. So like, you know, it's a theme over on AA's side of things. And I very much agree with him. You know, he's like, don't psychologize. It's repulsive. You know, there's nothing more disgusting than someone coming in and trying to psychologize you. It's like all of them should be met the way that mouthy beggar was met in the Odyssey, where Odysseus just bop, punches him and shatters his jaw and he spits his teeth. That's how I think about, I don't want to endorse violence. You understand I'm speaking metaphorically.
Of course.
When people come at me with attempts to psychologize me, that's my native response. Never acted upon, metaphorical, but, from that direction, I mean, just look at somebody like Freud. Look at the kind of paralysis that can be introduced into a person. They even have the old line about it, the paralysis of analysis, right? You can basically just befuddle someone so thoroughly with your bullshit by causing them to question themselves that suddenly they'll be like, no, Grug should break you, right? And they're like, well, no, Grug, have I told you about a particular aspect you have to deal with, Grug? Right. And then Grug suddenly like, oh, I don't know.
Well, Yeah, I get it. I mean, I think you have to try to evaluate what the person's intentions are, because, you know, it's like let's say someone comes at you and psychologizes you. That's not necessarily the end of the world, and it's not necessarily an attack. I think sometimes it is. Clearly. Actually, it reminds me. I put up a speech a few weeks ago that I gave about a month ago. And you know, the person who wrote this comment might be listening now. But they said something. There was a comment underneath this speech video, and he said something like, "Good speech. You could have chosen a more interesting name for the main character, though."
That's kind of funny. Like, and if it was intended as a joke, that's kind of funny.
Yeah, I don't know.
Needs more cowbell.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, right? It's like he tried to think of just something that he could criticize, some negative comment that he could make. And, you know, because who cares? Who gives a fuck what the character's name is? It doesn't matter. And this is like the most silly criticism that you could make about it. Now, obviously, I've got to then hold back and think, okay, hold on. Are you paranoid? Are you being too sensitive? Maybe he just genuinely didn't like that character's name. But I think, and this is what I mean about evaluating, I think it was someone bullshitting. I think it was someone looking to, sort of concern trolling. You know, like, I'm going to say that it was overall quite good, but I'm going to give you one pointless criticism that doesn't matter, just to throw that in there. Now, as I say, I might have misread this, but I don't understand why you would care about the fucking character's name. It just seems irrelevant. So there, that's what I would say about that. I think you have to be, and, you know, also you've got to evaluate how much to care about something. You know, I'm not going to ban that person from my channel, right? That would be ridiculous.
Although sometimes the arbitrary exercise of power is salutary.
Yeah. I ban people for being antisocial, for being pointlessly rude. There was a thoughtful comment posted by someone during the last stream. Someone else replied to it with a very dismissive, like pointlessly dismissive remark. So I banned that person because I think that's creating a bad atmosphere. But I try not to ban people just for disagreeing with me. It's a bit silly.
Well, that's called trying not to be a dick. You know?
Exactly. I mean, I don't need them to agree with me all the fucking time. You know, that would be silly. But yeah, as for psychologizing, I did a video back at the start called, hold on a minute, I'll find you the exact title. It was called something like The Dark Need for Ad Hominem. And the point
of it... And I can hear you, I'm just grabbing a smoke, so it's going to take me 5 seconds. I can hear, I got Bluetooth in. Go on.
Yeah, it was The Dark Need for Ad Hominem. And the point of that was that, God, now I know how Lichtmess felt last year when I disappeared and he was having to keep talking.
I won't do you like
God,
that.
Thank God.
It's such a relief.
Yeah. And the point of that video was, I think it's often very relevant. I mean, someone's psychology is often very relevant to a discussion. Now, in theory, it's all about the arguments and it's all about what they've actually said. But often you can shortcut all of that by something like, so what was your relationship like with your mother? To use the most cliche one. Because often that is relevant. And really, all of the arguments they're presenting are sort of just silly. And if you actually identify their position, what the perspective that they're coming from, then you don't need to go through all these arguments. You can actually just get to the root thing. So psychologizing, I think it does have its place, but you've got to do it. Well, you've got to know why you're doing it, you know, because you might be doing it just as a manipulative measure, or you might be doing it for the reason I just said. So there you go.
Yeah. I don't know what to think about it, which is why I wanted to ask you, your thoughts, because I'm still up in the air about it. On my side, you know, I don't know how it's been for you. For me, a certain amount of it is, I always get tortuous and torturous. A certain amount of it, confused, a certain amount of it comes to be, amounts to tortuous navel gazing, you know, in some respects. You can get lost in that in ways that, you know, the grug is just going to cut right through. And thereby the grug shows himself low in neuroticism and, you know, excellent in using his head as a battering ram, right? But I'm not that type. And I've, as a result of my own self-honesty, I discovered that a long time ago. You know, I'm always going to be mildly neurotic. That's just how I'm tuned. And I'm always going to work and overwork and parse and analyze shit to a degree that, you know, at times might be a bit much. So for me, the idea is, you know, can it be valuable? And when I try to look at it in that fashion, just very straightforward, it's like an old video of mine that I did on a journal. Yeah, it's valuable to try to put down these aspects of yourself and not just put them down, but to review them. It becomes sort of an adjunct of your memory. And I mean, I just remember the first time I was like, wow, I've had these problems with these fucking women over my life. And it's like, oh, I break up with them or they break up with me, right? I said, you know what? This is interesting. And at 19, I sat down and I made a fucking map of every one of the gambits that I had arranged. And as a result of laying them out, I was like, wow, the first time, you know, well, I cheated on her and then told her later, or I cheated on her and didn't tell her, or she cheated on me and told me. And in each one of those cases, there were three characters. And I was like, holy shit, I'm sitting there on the floor at 19 with my big, you know, folded, I used a sketchbook, so I had bigger pages, right? And I'm just drawing all this crap out. And I'm like, wait a minute, it's either two males and a female, two females and a male, right? Because you're looking at the different ways that the whole cheating thing can happen. And I'm like, wow, I can see a core pattern here where I was raised by a single mother and I had an older brother. And I can see how I'm just telling the world now my background. This is almost like a woes moment. I saw that I was recreating a situation of trying to get the attention from my mother against my older brother, who you can understand would stand in perfectly for a male who's been with her longer. Right? So I'm like, wow, now I understand why I had a best friend and had to steal his girlfriend away from him. Now, I'm telling everybody all that ended by the time I was 19. But when I was a teenager, I was like, yeah, best friend, he's got a girlfriend and she's hot. Why am I so powerfully attracted to her? Even to the degree that I would be willing to threaten my friendship with this guy who say is my friend. And then I'm like, oh, it's a pattern. You're a new child, comes in, want to take the attention of the mother, which you need to survive away from this older brother who's been with her longer, right? I saw a pattern. That to me seems useful. It doesn't mean I want to do it forever, but in recognizing that, in seeing it, it really did kind of free up psychic energy, right? It made me say, wow, no, I saw that. I walked through it. I don't have to do it blindly anymore. That goes over in the column of on the uses of psychology.
Yeah, definitely.
I think.
Yeah, I would definitely think. I mean, how did you react to having that new knowledge? I mean, did you stop doing that behavior?
Yes, I absolutely did. But it's because I found it on my own. And this kind of takes me to the next thing, which is that if you do it yourself, I remember a couple times where I saw something and I really did understand what that other person was kind of struggling with. You can do it in your own little ways. It's easier to see other people's problems than your own. Everybody knows that, right? And I found that every time I pointed it out to someone, they were not happy about it. And it was after a fashion as though I had robbed them of coming to their own realization. And it was almost like, if I'm really honest about it, it was almost as like they could sense that somehow deep inside them, this thing that they could have sorted out by themselves has now been complicated and twisted. Yes. Because now they're going to have to go back and work it out again in some new way, just so that they could have been the ones who did it themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, you've robbed them of that moment of self-realization, self-understanding. I mean, something I've learned very recently is that sometimes it's best not to tell people, you know, if you do have some thought about them, you don't need to tell them. Sometimes it's better not to, precisely for this kind of reason, because it's unwelcome. They don't want to hear it. And you might well be wrong as well. I mean, I'm wrong as much as I'm right, you know. I've got this, I sometimes think I've got this reputation for being good at psychology. Presumably I am because, well, in your estimation, because you've brought this topic to me, I'm guessing.
But we're talking about that other kind people, of guy. Yeah. Other people versus yourself.
Yeah. In my own case, I really often misunderstand things in other people. You know, I'll overanalyze something or underanalyze it, you know. So, you know, that, again, that's another thing I've come to accept about myself recently. I think when I was young, I wanted to impress myself. I mean, what young guy doesn't? And so I didn't accept certain limitations. But nowadays, you know, as you get older, you get more secure and it's much less painful to admit I'm really not good at that thing. You know, I can freely say that I'm terrible at navigation. I'm terrible. I'm not good at maths. And it doesn't bother me at all. But, you know, when I was young, it would have hurt me to say that stuff.
Not to be good at navigation, that can be a deal killer, you know?
Well, that's just one example.
You could die.
Yeah. Obviously, I'm using that as an example. But another one would be sometimes I misread social situations. I mean, that's a fuck. That is a bummer. Because, you know, especially because it suggests autism. But I and as for that's a whole thing, you know. I don't know. I really don't know. Maybe I'm a high functioning autist. I'm not sure.
There might be a lot of that going around in these.
Oh yeah. Who the fuck would notice another autist around here? Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I think it's easy to overanalyze things. Sometimes a lot of stuff is just simple in life. You know, that's another thing. You know, I think a lot of stuff is, we have a tendency now to, it's sort of encouraged in the culture to analyze and assume that everything's really complicated, and it's not really. That's another thing I've realized is that, like, men are, I think, are more complicated than women. Mentally, intellectually, because each guy has a very unique thing that he has to do in life. It's very specific to each guy, which I don't think is the case with women. And that's not to denigrate women. I just think it's the case. I forgot where I was going with this.
Well, it was the idea of whether or not you have to tell them. Whether or not it's well, that's one thread, and also where it is and isn't useful. But yeah. This had to do with misreading, was it?
Yeah. Well, I was saying about people's goals in life, but either way, I think that it's easy to. I was saying that it's encouraged now to overanalyze things and to assume that there's a big story somewhere. Oh, yeah. Something I've realized recently is that I think men are more complicated than women, but the needs of each guy are, you can broadly say that every guy should try to become as self-sufficient as possible and try to become as skilled as possible, try to become socially agile to whatever extent he can, and needs those things. So the advice to give 1,000 different lost young men is pretty much the same from one guy to the next. It's forgive your parents for any mistakes they made. Just write it off if you can. And forgive yourself for the flaws that you have and that drive you nuts and that piss you off and make you insecure and make you self-conscious. And don't care too much about what other people think of you. Really don't that's a big one. And just try to become self-sufficient. That's basically the path of male self-actualization, I think.
I think that fits. And it actually, you're bringing up kind of a... See, I thought I had a... How do I say this? I thought I had a binary situation, right? Uses, abuses, right? And where I was going to go was the basic idea of basically psychoanalyzing yourself versus letting anyone else do it, right? And anyone else who's going to be permitted to approach with something that is so often culturally used as a weapon to unman you, to cause you to be paralyzed with processing potentialities rather than acting, right? Dazzling you with bullshit, as they used to say, right? That would be over on the abuses. So good if you do it yourself. Maybe other people can do it, but generally if it's an outsider, fuck off if you want to do this, right? But you just introduced sort of the division with male and female, which kind of then gives you four positions, right? In my autism. And so this brings like another subject up because of this. And I think you were kind of unconsciously or consciously going towards this, which is very interesting, the difference between the males and the females, because I was just doing a thing on Twitter about this where somebody mentioned psychology. Maybe I was talking to D or something. We're talking, basically we'd all come across a bunch of women. And probably there are many people who have come across this themselves where women are like, oh, I studied psychology so I can understand all the head games, right? There's actually a type, and it's actually a species of female that's more offensive than an English major. It's a psychology major female.
Oh God. You know, yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. Yeah.
Among the red flags. Right. Yeah. And I think you hit on it with, the simplicity of the male thing. In my mind, I'll associate that with the archetypal, like, kill the dragon male thing, right? Kill the dragon, get the princess, right? What's left? You know, if Shakespeare is any guide, then you're left, because they used to say if a man knew Shakespeare, nothing could trick him, right? Because he would have understood the various gambits and arrangements of the archetypal characters, right? Because each play covers some dimension of that. And so maybe you're left with like a King Lear, right? Where you have killed the dragon, you have gotten the maiden, you have had kids, you were the king, and then look at what the fucking shit is left to you. I'm sure that there are, you know, adult males who are like, oh, I thought I had killed the dragon, and look what I'm leaving before I depart this world, right? That maybe you get twists like that, but otherwise it's pretty straightforward. Women, on the other hand, I have often thought of, and I've talked about it before, as being tripartite. So you have like Hecate Trimorphos, right? The triple goddess, right? Maiden, mother, and crone. Bubble, bubble, toil, and trouble, you know? The idea of three witches or these three phases, and I've seen that with women. They're actually three different fucking people, man. I put that in a poem once. Something about the maiden's choice never binds the mother because someone else made it. And people have read that poem and been like, oh, what are you trying to say? When they were younger, they got forced into a decision by a man? I'm like, no, I'm saying they were a different fucking person.
Yeah.
And somehow they liked you. They thought you were cute. They got married. They had a kid. Now they're a mother. They're a totally new person. And they look over at you and go, fuck off, man. Who are you?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's also a danger of when a woman cannot progress from one to the next. So you've got I'm thinking about the young woman who is stuck there being the succubus or I don't know what words you'd want to use, but
that works poetically.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the sort of borderline girl who, you know, it's kind of sexy for a woman to be like that when she's in her 20s. But, but you know, if she's 40 and she's like that, and she's still trying to use her sex to control men, what you've got is a tragedy. It's kind of like you could say similar things about there are equivalents for men as well. But I think men can sort of get away with it more than women can because of the biological imperative. You know,
and the fact that we stay fertile, right? Which is must be.
Yeah, exactly. That, right? Yeah, that's what I mean. You know, men can become fathers later on in life. It doesn't matter. But by and large. But with women, there is a thing that a woman has to do in her 20s or even before. There is a thing that women have to do in their 30s. There is a thing that women, that path is sort of laid out. And so if a woman cannot progress from one to the next, I think it's a sign, it's a sign of a problem. And, you know, nowadays the archetype, the phenomenon of the borderline girl or the histrionic girl is much more prevalent than I think it was in the past. And I think it's partly because society no longer guides them to make the correct decisions. So you end up with this, you know, the 40-year-old who's trying to live it up like she's still in her 20s, and you just can't, it's obviously not going to work. I mean, it's a tragedy. I think that feminism has just absolutely, it's been a massive, massive betrayal of so many women, and it's going to really leave them fucked up in a huge way.
Tragedy with cat piss. Yeah. the way it kind of unfolds further there, though, is, so what we've got is the idea of doing it for yourself versus doing it with a group, and then what the aims are, right? As you pointed out, and I think you're right, you know, that everything that you set forth as a basic set of advice, become more self-reliant, right? What's the problem? Like any male is going to get that, right? Whether you do that in terms of social standing, or you decide you want to be a mountain man, and instead you're doing the whole to build a fire thing, right? Your boots got wet and you're going to freeze to death if you don't get a fire started, right? Whatever the level is where your own personal requirements and life adventure take you, right? It's still gonna be, like you say, this thing about, I will measure myself against the circumstances and find, you know, however slender a reed of self-reliance in it and grow thereby.
Absolutely. What I said was that men, it's men are more complicated than women, just to be clear. But it's partly because each guy has a fucking huge number of things to get through in order to become himself, in order to self-actualize. But broadly speaking, it all comes under this umbrella of self-sufficiency. And the other strand that it comes under is learning not to care about things, learning not to, like, that person wronged me, that person let me down, this thing didn't turn out as I'd hoped. Part of being a man is learning not to care about any of those things. Not, like, obviously not to let people walk all over you, but just not to get hurt when they do, or that they have done in the past. In other words, learning to be sort of bulletproof. And obviously this is never absolute, of course, right? Not. But basically life is, life does a lot of things to you, and you need to be as resilient as possible, often to a ridiculous degree. Things that would break your heart when you were 15 or 20 happen to you at 40, and it just doesn't matter. Water off a duck's back, really.
Yeah, happened to me this week. Yeah, something that would have thrown me into a tailspin for a while. Just had a falling out with a friend who didn't even think it was like required to even tell me why. You know, somebody I've known since I was 15 or 14 or something. You know, it's just ridiculous. It was like a punch in the gut. And then 2 days later, I'm like, you know, I've often said it before. It's like, you know, once you get burned enough times, you start to look like the inside of a cast iron pot. I mean, what the fuck are you going to do to it? You know, it's like, did you mar my paint job? I'm like, no, I've got carbon built up on all surfaces, you know, fuck off. But I think that there's a way to not have a contradiction in what we're talking about. Yes, it is straightforward, but it's complex, to your point, in the sense that there are as many solutions to that puzzle as there are individual men. So it's a straightforward thing, but the application is going to vary enormously. So if we take it over to the other side, you know, like we say, we've got a quaternity now instead of a binary. It's not just the uses and the abuses, whether it's you individually or the group trying to come do it to you, right? But now we've got the idea of masculine and feminine. Well, what you find with women Well, I mean, I think I've talked about this before. I've certainly talked about it many times on my channel. Maybe I've punished you with it. But the basic idea is that men hunting war parties, they go out. It's where I always talk about go, 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 where the soldiers go. And they do hand gestures and they're silent, right? And they have to be quiet and they'll be like, right? This whole thing of the squad, right? Which is also the hunting party, right? From my perspective, for men, you leave the family and the new social group you go to is men. And that is about hunting or by extension, war. One of the things that you don't do is run your fucking mouth when you're hunting an animal, or they'll hear you and run off, right? And hence the emphasis on hand gestures and all this bullshit in army movies. You know, are they all this bullshit? It's silent. And at the end of the day, it's measured. Are you self-sufficient? Are you a good hunter? Did you bring home food? Or are we fucking hungry again? Women, on the other hand, are doing things in groups. And so they're going out there and some of them are smashing the lizard on the head with a rock and throwing it into, they tuck their skirts up to make a bag out of it and toss it in there. And then they might come across some nuts and then they'll grab some fruit that's hanging here and they just graze, right? But they're also keeping the kids around and the kids are making noise. And in any case, they're all making a stench, right? I mean, not to be evil to women, but they produce scents. Babies produce scents. They shit all over the place. They pee. They make smells, right? Whereas hunters, for example, will have to piss in a bottle so the prey doesn't smell it and you don't come back to that place and find that there's no game to be had, right? So we have to be continent. We have to shut our damn mouths and we even have to control how we pee. This is an aspect that has to do with come in quietly, find your thing, find your target, accurately read the signs, identify it, and take it down. Women are in a different situation. They're moving as groups. And so what I've noticed with them is they do this, I talked about it many times, but they sing to each other. It's like when they meet each other, they go, oh, hi, Linda. Be, oh, hi. Hi, Sally. And they'll pitch themselves and they'll sing along, right? Oh, it's so good to see you. Oh, so good to see you too. Oh, I love your shoes. Oh, what a lovely necklace. How are you doing? Everybody's singing to indicate that they're at the same emotional level and there's no stress, right? And when they're working together in groups, they're listening to some sound of dissatisfaction from the female off to one side, right? And it doesn't matter what the words are. They don't give a damn what the words are. It's the song. Is the song harsh? Is there a discordant note over here? Let me go address the discordant note. What's the matter? Right? Well, I was just saying that I wanted a glass of milk. Well, we understand, honey. It's not about the glass of milk. It's the way you said it, honey. Right? Or look at like when men and women fight. The man's like, I was trying to tell you that I fucking, this is what matters, and this is why I told you. And the woman's like, don't talk to me that way. And you're like, I'm just using fucking words because language is supposed to be where I communicate something to you. And now you're freaking out about the tone that I say it. I'm telling you words. And she's like, you're not telling me words. You're telling me it's an emotional state, and it's got me upset. Right. That's a collective thing of pressure, of not creating ripples, of making sure that everybody's good because we all have to cooperate. Because if I'm carrying a child around and nursing over here, then I can't be getting the food at the same time, which is why I need you as a partner. Or even think about a woman when she starts to waddle around and her hip girdle starts to literally open up as her bones expand and, you know, her whole pelvic floor shifts. She gets heavier and heavier. She can't run as fast. Out in the wild, that means something can chase her down and eat her. So she needs help. That's why women come to you when you're starting a relationship with them and they won't even know they're doing it. They'll just do shit to really piss you off. And it's to see how you react because they might be reliant upon you later. And they want to test you now to see how you react if they really piss you off. So that's a different psychological world. Not only do you have the maiden mother crone thing, but you have a strong reliance upon others that's very different with how a war party works, you know, or even a football team. You know, you trip like a fag. What the Absolutely. Fuck is your problem?
Yeah, I mean, with a male group, is always not always. It's like, it's actually two extremes. The male group is either intensely driven towards the goal, the mission, the point, or they're fucking around. They're banter and sort of leisure. And it's two extremes. And I think women find both of those extremes quite offensive. Like banter, women take it far more seriously. I mean, female groups don't banter. It doesn't happen because they take it so seriously. But then the opposite extreme of being obsessed with the goal, women would find that inhuman and cold and mechanical.
And why would you say that I'm not performing as well? You know, if you're the kind of person who told me that I didn't gather as much berries as you did, what if I'm pregnant and I can't go out and do those things? And then what would you think of me then? Right.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that, and again, men are just expected to suck it up. Like, okay, you're being criticized right now. You better fucking take the criticism on board. You better listen because you have to get good at achieving the goal. Because if you can't achieve the goal, then you're no use to anyone, including yourself. So, whereas with women, there's so much more is, and I don't want to see, this is going to sound dreadfully sexist, and maybe I need to think more about this, but I think there just isn't that obsession about the goal. It's far more feeling oriented. And how, so the purpose with male groups is the goal. The purpose with female groups is the well-being of the individuals within it.
Yes, because they will be there is not a creature on earth with less mercy. There is not a creature on earth more utterly fucking uncompromising and cold-hearted than a woman who has seen that you're not going to be able to protect her in the way that matters. They will scrape you the fuck off their shoe like dog shit, man, without thinking twice. I mean, anyone that's got her head screwed on, one who doesn't have her head screwed on will come up with ways to talk about it, but, you know, or explain it to herself or rationalize it. But she's going to be looking at you in her rearview mirror before long, no matter how she tries to rationalize it. So absolutely, there is that difference with the goal orientation. But I also agree with you in the sense that that protection angle, they do have a line that gets drawn. It's just it's for you. It's not for her, you know.
Yeah, it is a difficult thing. I mean, yeah, I don't want to give men, because this will be watched by quite a lot of young men, and I don't want to give them the impression that women just see you as literally a provider and protector, because I don't think that's true. But everything is different if you can provide and protect for them. And if you can't, it's a very difficult situation. And again, this is something that our modern world, our modern culture, absolutely does not tell young men. And it's really a crime that this isn't drummed into every young man. Basically, the woman needs you to take care of her. And it's complicated. It's going to differ from one couple to the next. There will be ways in which she looks after you. You could say that's the whole point, that she's taking care of you while you're attending to the goal, whatever it may be. That's all true, but she needs to look up to you. She needs to feel safe with you. And if she doesn't, then you're going to have severe problems. And, you know, we see this in modern relationships, really going back, I would say, at least three generations. I mean, I can remember seeing, and I'm not going to be specific, but I can remember seeing people in the generation, two generations above me. So people born in the 1920s. And I can remember seeing couples in my childhood. I would see the friends of my grandparents, where the woman would occasionally say something bitchy about the guy. Now, that's going back now, 4 or 5 generations. so it goes back a long way. The rise of what you would now call feminism, this growing disrespect that women have for men, and now it culminates now with things with, well, I mean, modern couples where the stereotypical thing is the woman doesn't even realize that she is there to serve the guy and help him in his life goals. And the guy doesn't even realize that he's supposed to have life goals and that he's supposed to provide and protect for the women. You know, I mean, the sexes have been lied to each to about each other so effectively at this point that the relations between them are completely fucked. It's just dreadful. I mean, and this isn't an original point in any way. We, you know, this has been said for years in our sphere, but it never ceases to amaze me how bad it is. And because I can remember growing up thinking, you know, being told men and women are the same. They're men who want to be in charge of and want to dominate women are insecure, and dominate, that's a difficult word. That's a very difficult word because obviously it leads to all sorts of connotations. But a man who wants to be the breadwinner, a man who wants to be in the head of his family, well, that's a guy who's insecure. And insecure is an allegation that's thrown at men all the time. And this is actually a really good example of the uses and abuses of psychology, because I think men naturally are insecure, especially when they're young, and for good reason. You're supposed to be insecure because you're,
for all those reasons you just talked about,
exactly,
the group and the men and the pressure, and you must perform, and it matters.
Exactly. Absolutely, exactly. So it's right that the young man is bristling with uncertainty about his abilities because he hasn't fucking proven his abilities yet. So, absolutely. But at the same time, And insecurity does, I think, stay with guys throughout. And I'm maybe not old enough to pontificate on this very reliably, but I think insecurity does stay. It calms down. You become much more comfortable with yourself. But I think probably most guys retain insecurities about some things throughout their whole lives. It's one of those things. It's not the end of the world. It's, you can live with it, and you learn to live with it. You learn to watch it, monitor it, and not let it catch you unawares and all that. But nonetheless, it's embarrassing for a guy to be told that he's insecure about something, because you hope that by a certain age, you've overcome all of that and you're not insecure anymore. So when someone tells you, hey, ooh, looks like I just struck a chord there. it's fucking annoying because it's like, oh yeah, you did. I have a vulnerability there. I have something I haven't got over. Whatever. It's fucking annoying. And so this is why I think that feminism, one of the big weapons in feminism, is to say that men are insecure, because it's like saying he's incomplete. He's vulnerable. He's a rough draft of the guy he should be. He hasn't made it. He hasn't made the great, his own great. And thus he is vulnerable, and thus he is kind of laughable, because women suddenly, as you said, become very ruthless. And a guy who's merely a rough draft of himself, a guy who's not complete, is a guy who's a fuck up. And so then that leads to a feedback loop. So the woman shows contempt, so the guy feels vulnerable in that way. Then that makes her feel even more contempt, and it goes on and on. I think a large part of the correct rearing of women in society is accept that men are insecure and don't make a fucking meal out of it. Because conversely, the opposite of that would be, well, you know, woman, you are insecure about your looks. Well, guess what? This guy's just noticed that you've got a big nose. You know, in other words, we can both fucking hurt each other. Both sexes can hurt each other. And And so feminism has gifted women this weapon that they can use against men. They can say, oh, you're insecure. And again, it's another trick of feminism, because in the end, it doesn't work. It doesn't work for women either. It's like a short-term, immediate thing where she gets to hurt a guy. But in the long run, what that does is it leaves her as the childless cat lady.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's an important point that you raised about a bunch of young men watching this, because, you know, my process of maturation, such as it is so pathetic that I don't even think about those differences, you know, because I guess I haven't matured at all. But by comparison, yeah, probably in some ways I have. So I should make a clear point, sort of following on the heels of what you just said earlier about, you know, young men are watching this and you don't want to give them the wrong impression. I certainly don't as regards being able to protect a woman, because 99.9% of the time with a woman, what she's going to want to see as protection from you is you anticipating a problem and it never happening. You know, some young guy who comes along who thinks that what I was just talking about means he's got to bow up and huff and puff and like start a fight, or, you know, make a big pull a Will Smith at the whatever that fucking award ceremony was where he went primeval. No, they don't appreciate that. If you find one who does like to wind you up and see you fight other people and beat them down, you have the most dangerous, most poisonous type of woman ever created by man. And that specific type of female is the one who fills prisons one way or another. So don't walk, run. I guess what I'm trying to say is that, yeah, don't think when I say that you have to be able to protect a woman that she's going to expect you to, like, you know, go jump in there with, you know, whatever guys, you know, headbutt them and then glass them in the neck or something. No. What I'm talking about, the women are going to appreciate it if you're able to simply see the problem coming and move straight past it in such a fashion that it's like a bull with a fucking, you know, a bullfighter with a red rag, you know, go run over there and now we're leaving. Come on, darling. Right. They appreciate that much more than other things. And if you have one who doesn't appreciate that, yeah, stay away.
Oh, absolutely. And this is something where women have an advantage over men, because men, when they're young, again, and this is yet another sort of initiation ritual that men have to go through, is learning about women. Whereas women, I think, have a certain innate understanding.
There ain't that much to figure out about us. Difficult to figure out about a man is difficult for that man. Woman. Yeah.
No, exactly. I think they have a much more innate understanding. And so what that means, and you know, that's probably for evolutionary reasons. It's probably for perfectly good reasons. But what it leaves you with is, if you need a society to take care of this stuff for you, in we don't have a society that takes care of this stuff for us. So therefore, we are vulnerable to women's manipulations. And there are some women who delight. I mean, I remember when I was 18, in a nightclub, and I said something, I can't remember even what it was, but it was obvious to a young woman, and it was obviously a joke. She went off to her boyfriend, and it was months later that I was in the same nightclub, and I saw this girl, and I vaguely recognized her. She was chatting to her boyfriend, and then the boyfriend came up to me and said something that basically, this girl had tried to engineer a fight between her boyfriend and me, a guy that she'd had a conversation with months earlier, like 6 months earlier or something. And I remember, and I said to the guy, look, I don't know what's going on here. I've got nothing against you. Don't worry about it. It's nothing. And that was the truth. But this girl had obviously wanted to see her guy, and we're talking about 18-year-olds here. I mean, it's all ridiculous. But she'd wanted to see her guy beating another guy up for her. And that's an example. You know, you can understand when people are young, sort of sharpening their claws. They're trying to find out what they can get away with, and, you know, how hot am I? Will a guy beat another guy up for me, kind of thing. But I remember thinking at the time, geez, that could have been ugly. You know, that could have been a bad situation. It probably wouldn't have been, but it could easily have been. And she just did that for the sake of it. I mean, I'm sure there are loads of guys, probably yeah. most guys have had at least one experience like that, where there was almost a pointless fight just because some young women wanted to find out, basically, how hot am I?
Yeah. I mean, I ran into a few problems of my own creation with the women directly. I've gotten two black eyes now from women. I've been kicked between the legs more than once by women, probably only twice. And then there was the time in Istanbul, just because I thought it was a great expression and I had learned it and I thought it was funny. You know, like saying a curse word in a foreign language, for you, it's like Monopoly money, you know? It's like a play game, right? But when you say it in, I remember there's this redheaded Irish chick in a bar in Istanbul, and I said, lie back and think of England. And that just did not go over well then. I ended up with a pint of beer on me. Yeah.
And I'm sure it was Guinness, so, yeah. right?
Oh, no, I don't know what the hell. They were serving FS or whatever. You couldn't get Guinness in Turkey at that time. But no, I had, see, for some reason, I got the women. Yeah, they were directly willing to fight me. Maybe I'm not necessarily imposing enough, you know. But there is that definitely the females, they come in and they can cause you serious trouble, especially when you're young and you are not yet clear on the various ways that these things happen. You know, I mean, there are probably 500 cases or 500 things in the course of a year that you just walk past as an adult who knows about them without getting tangled up in them like tar babies or screwed or whatever, you know, whereas people who are younger and who don't know about those things yet, can get hooked by them. Yeah. As my old friend Tim used to say, in reference to women, he's like, well, I will accept the designation, the fair sex. But I will not accept the gentle sex designation. No. So yeah, you have to be careful with them.
Yes, definitely. Now, this has ended up being a sort of double A side stream, where the first half was about one topic, and the second half has been about a completely different topic,
right.
which is very right. unusual for me and for Millennial. Is there anything else that you wanted to say about this before we...
No. It's been interesting to hear your stories, though. And I'm glad I pulled up out of the nosedive of the machine gun flow of words at you. You know, so this time, this is my personal growth, my own personal growth. And I'll enter it in my little journal. And this is my own little step towards, becoming something more than I currently am, which is that I managed to run my mouth without pause only for the first hour.
See,
leaving another hour free.
One thing that occurs to me is another point that I could make is one way to get to know yourself is to work out, to track what you say, what you yourself say, and look for contradictions. Because I've actually done one. I've made a contradiction in this stream. Because at first I said that I know my... Well, no. At first I said that I could do with reviewing the last 8 years and finding stuff out about myself and analysing this and that about what happened. But then latterly I said that I know myself very well. That's not a total contradiction, but it's a kind of... Because obviously I feel confident about, in one way about self. Yeah, I know myself very well. But there's also this, what about this 8 years? I haven't really digested that yet. So that's an interesting thing. Just as an example of... Look out for this in yourselves, guys, because what you say about yourself or about the world, any topics really, is... The contradictions in your own statements can be illuminating. That's what I would just a thing there.
Especially when you're dealing with females, because they can God love them. I don't know how they get the special powers, but they don't have to arrive at understandings about you based on rational processes, you know, and everybody talks about intuition versus rational, this and that. And it's that's all cute. And in many respects, just kind of glosses over the reality of it, which is that a woman can essentially just smell some shit about you. Now, I'm not saying literally she smells it, though sometimes there can be that too. They'll just know some shit about you and can read it off of you, and they don't need to have engaged in ratiocination to figure it out. And the primary place where that ability of theirs is brought to bear is when you're talking some shit that's not true about yourself. So, you know, that dovetails with what you're talking about there, Wes.
Definitely. I mean, there's an example I could give of this, where I know a guy who has been taken advantage of by a few women, and it's a shame, because he's a damn good guy, but he hasn't learned yet how to protect himself against that happening. And yeah, it's a shame. But part of it is this, the reason I thought of that was that what you said, that women can smell certain vulnerabilities. They just know, and they zero in on guys like that.
And you can hate the power. You can hate it when it's used for evil, but it's the same power they use where they sit across you. You go out on a first date with a chick, right? And you start talking about some, like, it brings to mind those memes, you know, where the woman's like, oh, get the fuck away from me. And the guy's leaning in, being like, yeah, now did I tell you about how Rommel did on the, you know, in the Egyptian campaign, you know, and she's like, get the fuck away. But, you know, you'll sit down across from a woman, and if she happens to like you, you'll be spouting whatever shit it is that you think is going to interest her. And there's this weird dilation that occurs, often accompanied by a dilation of the pupils, and she'll be looking at you. And it doesn't matter what it is. She'll come up with some way. Unconsciously, they're not being evil about it. They'll come up with some way to, like, answer you in some fashion fitting within the whole framework you're talking about. Even if you're doing some intellectual thing and they're not even intellectual, they can take an impression from a dude and read it with some of their weird ass non-rational processes. And somehow, after the shit up here inside the machine spins around, this shit comes out of their mouth that fits perfectly and makes you feel like they were really fucking listening. And they had something to say that proved not only that they were listening, but you were intensely interesting to them. And you were, but there was no rational process between their listening and their answer. I'm overemphasizing that. They can think, they can be rational, right? But you get my point.
Oh, yeah. And again, this brings me back to a certain type of predatory young woman who's very prevalent today, who will do that even though she isn't interested in you. And she'll do that to make you think that she's really into you and you're a great match and you should get really excited.
How prevalent. Are they really that... Like,
I don't know the half of it. I'm 40. You know, there are guys in their 20s who are navigating today's dating scene, and the stuff I hear is like, oh my fucking God. All I can say is I think guys need to be, as I said, as self-sufficient as possible. It's not like it was in the 70s. It's not like it was in the 90s. It's definitely not like it was 100 years ago. Society does not help you anymore. That's the thing. And as I say, it's worse for guys who are younger than me. I'm not coming to you as a sort of emissary of what the 2020s dating scene is like.
Right. I'm like, tell me about the youth, Wolves. You're like, fuck if I know about the youth. Yeah.
It's prevalent. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So anyway, there we go. We'll now do the questions. So, Jesus. And I don't want to just to be clear, I don't want to discourage young men. All I'm saying is this is why I say to young men, you need to work on yourself, because it is tough out there. And that goes not just for the dating scene, it goes for life in general. Again, you can say a similar thing. It's not like it was 50 years ago. It's a tough world now.
Yeah, I'm glad I don't have to do it again. There are many things about youth I would love to go back to, and
I think you and I
figuring
have
out women is not something I want to do again. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. All right. Okay. So the questions. One-eyed fat man. What's with the name Semiogog? What's behind it?
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. The short answer is cobbler's children have no shoes, right? I'm in branding and advertising, or was for 30 years. And I just thought it sounded cool because it was a combination of semiotics and demagogue. That's it. It's absolutely impossible to spell. Nobody can find URLs or type the channel. My bad. Next question, please.
Okay, because I actually once misspelled it. I don't know if you noticed this. It was on Telegram, and I wrote a post about you, and I actually fucking realized later I misspelled the name, and I was
I was talking to John. I was talking to John D on a stream, and he played the first time I ever went on AA's channel. And AA, because of his dyslexia, is just calling me some shit. I can't even imitate what he was calling me, but it was something like semagogue, or I don't even fucking remember. Nobody can say it. Nobody can spell it. It's my bad. Yeah, it's proof of the fact that I never should have been entrusted with branding work.
Well, for what it's worth, I think it's a cool name, and I'm not just saying that.
Right.
All right. Lady of Shalott says, feminism has poisoned the well for all of us, men, women, and arguably worst of all, for children. Antinatalism is now well entrenched. How many young women will you encounter today who will tell you that they don't want kids due to some garbage excuse like climate change? Make motherhood great again. Yeah, I absolutely agree with this. And this was one of the main things in the speech that I gave. It was 6 weeks ago now. That
was the one where you laid out the fictional vision of a world that, yes, that we would like. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that was one of the big things in it, was that society should understand that what most young women should be guided towards is becoming wives and becoming mothers. I'm not going to pretend to be some sort of monk or a complete prude. I'm off my generation. I'm off this age like the rest of us, but I'm not even like absolutist about this, but as a general rule, this is definitely true, even more so for women, but also for men as well. I think that casual sex can be fun, but it can also be very unrewarding. And, it's exciting when, especially when you're young. But basically, I do think that most, certainly in the case of women, their main thing is motherhood. And any culture that doesn't guide them towards that, and any culture that doesn't facilitate the formation of families, is a culture that drastically needs to be changed. This is obvious stuff, really.
I can't argue with that. All I'd add is that at the end of a long career of chasing skirts, all I found I had was I've used the metaphor before. It's like fairy dust. You know, you go under the hill and they're playing the music, you know, and Oberon's going to tell you a long story, and you're going to get drunk, and you're going to fill your belly, and then you're going to crawl out from under the hill 60 fucking years later with like a long ass beard, thinking it was just one night, and you're scrawny as shit because all you ate was dust. So you just cough up fucking dust. That's what the wages of being a skirt chaser are, really.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there is a happy medium that I guess would have been in the 70s when people had their fun in their early 20s, late teens. But then they settled down by 25. Right. You know, if only that happy medium could be sustained, then that would be great. But the reality is, it can't be. The forces, the dynamics of society, are always moving, are always pushing things in certain directions. So Yeah, there we go. All right, Siema Ziomek says, Samuel Gog, Poland wasn't made by the West. Poland didn't receive weapons. It bought them with good reason, looking at history. With Intermarium, you're blowing a dead idea out of proportion. No one serious in Poland is thinking of pursuing it. Law and Justice Party are US tools and traitors.
That sounds like half agreeing with me in the first place. I mean, there are all kinds of points I could raise. Like, you know, does the US sell weapons to just anybody who has money? Not exactly. Depends on the weapons. You know, I mean, there are all kinds of little ways that I could niggle about it. I don't feel like fighting about it. I'm perfectly happy if that person has another opinion. And anybody who doubts me should go listen to that person too and assemble a picture based on more opinions than mine. That's fine. Go in peace, brother.
Excellent. All right. Lampshade says, Woes next year invite American Krogan, Richard Houck, and Jim Gold. I probably will. Okay, Five of Swords says, Semiogog recommended a book to me via Twitter, Eric Neumann's Origin of Consciousness, which perfectly answered the questions I had at the time. I really appreciate the recommendation.
Origins in the History of Consciousness. I hope that he read that Neumann book, as I must have doubtless said, because that's the way it was introduced to me. Read the second half first. But in any case, yeah, it's that's more Jungian, not Freudian. And I think it was Jung himself who said that Jewish psychology created by Jewish people for Jews is a very different thing than Gentile psychology created by Gentiles for Gentiles. Of course, Jung being Swiss, Neumann comes out of Jung's tradition, and there's quite a bit that's interesting there. But of course, we can't go into it here. But I'm glad, glad you got the book. More power to you. Glad you liked it.
All right. And then finally, Stephen says, I do like a nice edifying Semiogog geopolitics rant that I'd never heard before he said it. Lol.
Oh, well, yeah, at least I can say that. The takes are often original. I don't know, in Eastern Europe, maybe I just once again, as I've done so many times in my life, I just reinvented sliced bread. but to me, it's a new way of looking at it. And I'll throw one last one in for you, which is something that just occurred to me yesterday. Have no idea if it's true, but boy, it is a tantalizing way of looking at it, which is that Chernobyl was the best thing that ever fucking happened to Russia, because it caused all of Europe that was well along the path to nuclear power to completely stop using any of it and become an enormous, hungry market for exactly what Russia a short time later had to sell, which is oil and natural gas. And you know what's crazy? Chernobyl, where it went up? Ukraine. Now, I do want to add that I'm not saying necessarily that the Russians did it. But there's another revisionist take for you. Your mileage may vary. Don't give a shit if you don't like it. Don't listen to me. I've been proven wrong in 100 different ways. I'm not claiming I'm right. The people who've known me for a long time who still come to my channel, come because you'll get crazy ass takes that nobody thought of. And some of them will be plausible. But I'd have to say that so far my prediction rate, it's about 50-50, which is the same thing as totally random. So, you know, come enjoy my channel. But yeah, recognize that, yeah, it doesn't always work out. Sounds good, though.
But it will at least be thought-provoking and delightful. And, of course, they'll have the pleasure of your great charisma.
Yes, indeed. Right. How could I forget my charisma? I'm still fucking laughing, man, when you told that story about when Martin freaked out because he went away from the camera. I was controlling my laughter after you told that story because it was a deeply... I'm sorry. It was a deeply uncomfortable moment. Martin was not fucking happy.
I know.
I'm sorry. At the time, that was a classic.
It was this thing. It was this black bit on top of the... can you see? Yeah, I think you can. Yeah, yeah.
Right, right.
That black bit fell off. And I was looking... I was like, oh, fuck. Where is it?
Herr Lichtnitz was not having it.
No, he certainly wasn't. He's going to be on in a few days from... When is he on? Hold on a second. Let me see.
Right on. Everybody should check that out. Martin is awesome. I still feel that I must revisit the goth stream because he was not allowed to shine as he did, should have, and would have. Yes, yeah, Martin's awesome.
Oh, he's great. He's great. He's on in 2 days from now, so that should be great. I'm looking forward to that. Now, I should say that tomorrow night I was due to have four. Computing Forever, then The Woodlander, then Paul Fahrenheit, then Blair Cottrell. But Computing Forever has had to pull out, and so has Blair Cottrell. So I don't know what's going to happen. I'll see if I can... there are some people who are on a sort of waiting list, a short waiting list, but nonetheless, there is one. And so I'll see if they can fill in those two slots. Otherwise, there will be only two streams tomorrow night. And then it'll be back to business as usual the next night. So we'll see how that goes. But anyway, so this is it. This is the end of the fifth night of Millennial 8. So thank you, Semiogog, for once again appearing on Millennial.
It's my great pleasure. I didn't open with all of that, but yeah, thank you again very much for having me on. It's always a lot of fun to be here, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. People always look forward to it, including me. And it certainly wasn't a disappointment. In fact, this has been the longest one so far. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes. So I need to get to beddy bye. So, all right. I will be back tomorrow night with some kind of itinerary. We'll see how it goes. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available in the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.